It's the network break. Brew up a coffee and spin up a virtual donut and join us for this Packet Pushers podcast on the latest news from the tech industry. We got analysis, opinion, insight, and the occasional rant. I'm your host, Drew Condry Murray, and with me as always is the ineffable Greg Farrow. Greg, how are you?
I'm not too bad. Haven't felt this good in quite some time, really. Nothing to report from the Western Front.
Then let us move on. And before we dive into the news, I want to thank Interop for being our sponsor today. And the Packet Pushers are hosting a two-day Future of Networking Summit. That's May 2nd and 3rd at Interop Las Vegas in 2016. And we'll tell you more about it later on. And diving right in, last week we had talked about the Cisco versus Arista legal brouhaha. And this week we found out that the U.S. ITC, International Trade Commission, had its initial ruling and did in fact declare that Arista has violated three Cisco patents.
It doesn't – no, the ITC doesn't rule on patent violations. It rules that, in their opinion, that Arista has transgressed existing patents and therefore Cisco is entitled to redress.
Yes.
Before a federal court will listen to the court legal case, okay? So the International Trade Commission, or the ITC, is a body set up to decide that if somebody is breaching copyright, that they can prevent those products which are breaching copyright laws or services can be prevented from continuing. So Cisco's taken it to the ITC and said, Arista's violating our patents. Please stop them from importing products that match our patents.
Yeah.
The reason for that is that the ITC court works much, much faster than
the U.S. The legal system.
The yep. U.S. federal court, which is – and therefore Cisco's looking – this is where we go to the conclusion that Cisco's actually looking to cut Arista off from its customers by preventing it from being able to sell products. Instead of just fighting the copyright and saying Arista's stolen our ideas and stolen our technologies and then having a copyright battle – it's this extra step of going to the ITC and asking the ITC to prevent Arista's products from being imported to the US. That's what makes it a competitive move, not a moral issue, if you like.
Right. Yeah, it's not just you've infringed on patents, you need to pay us licensing fees or whatever or some other redress. They're actually trying to essentially run Cisco Arista out of business, it seems like.
Yeah, and that's – I think they'll be doing two things. If they're talking to very large customers, which Cisco does, they manage those accounts directly themselves, and they're up against Arista, who has been taking a substantial amount of business, then – as is evidenced by their share price and, you know, various reports that we've seen, Arista is actually making good ground, then Cisco's going to say, but look, we're suing them and they might not be able to bring those products in 6 months' time or 3 months' time if we can win. Therefore, you shouldn't build a strategy around Arista because they're not going to be around for long.
Right.
You know, it's an underhanded business practice. Certainly, it's playing to win, if you know what I'm saying. But equally, it's going to help within the short term, I think.
You think it's going to help Cisco in the short term?
I can't see why not. I mean, it's a powerful strategy for people who are afraid of everything. Enterprise IT is not exactly known for its risk-taking.
For boldness.
You know, it might be enough to tip a couple of, you know, multi-million dollar deals back in Cisco's favor that might have been going away. So the question is whether it's profitable or not is hard to determine. You are looking at an awful, you know, and as I said in an article I wrote this week, an artillery barrage of lawyers.
These don't come cheap, these kinds of suits and these pursuits. Yes, they mm-hmm. definitely don't come. Yeah, I was thinking about that this morning. What is the ROI here for Cisco? Because so this ruling from the ITC is just an initial ruling. I guess there's going to be another ruling, a final determination coming in the second quarter. But clearly Arista in the meantime is taking steps to get themselves out of this infringement. They can take technical steps to make fixes that will, I presume, you know, sort of clear them from this box. So in the end, I can't anticipate that Arista is actually going to be barred from selling product.
Well, who knows? You know, I'm no legal expert and I can only go based on reading articles and chatting to people. Mm-hmm. I think it's unlikely that Arista is going to lose access to the markets. But I think what Cisco is doing here is a couple of different things. One is Arista's taking market share and profit from Cisco. Cisco feels the need to respond. It hasn't been able to do that by normal means, that is by building better products or by on a pricing point or on a maintenance point, or customers are obviously not necessarily just signing up with Cisco for whatever reasons. There must be many. So they've decided to take this additional step and compete in the legal arena. So if that's the case, then Cisco's got to make some decisions about what it wants to do in the market, right? Keep in mind as well is that every sale of an Arista product is an ACI product, not sold. Now, I've had a couple of different rumors and emails from people this week about ACI, and one person was telling me that apparently the top execs in ACI are actually ringing the sales teams around the world to tell them, ask them why they're not selling more ACI products. Mm. And, you know, if I was a customer and I had Cisco going, you can't, you know, clearly the Nexus 7000 is not the future for a lot of people. Some people like it, a lot of people don't. ACI is trying to do too much at once, I feel, and maybe it's scaring people away. And then people could go to Arista and say, well, it's a better Nexus 7000. It's, you know, it's better priced. It's simpler to use. You know, it's everything the 7000 is that I want. I don't have to worry about line cards and fuss. But it's not ACI. I don't have to make this commitment to a platform, throw out all my existing switches and replace them with ACI. Mm-hmm. And I can't help but wonder if that's sort of like multiple threats. And there's a secondary thing here is there are other vendors who've been moving towards more and more of an iOS CLI, open source projects too, for example. They're all looking to use that same, you know, ConfT, IP, you know, interface, Ethernet Zero, all that sort of stuff. That's become very much a standard in the industry. Open source projects are doing it. So in a sense, by taking on Arista, Cisco is signaling that you can't just keep copying our stuff, which also says, and don't keep doing that or we're going to come after you. So it's also a note to, you know, Dell and Juniper, or not Juniper because their CLI is completely different. But you
Dell,
know, also
HP
and the Open Switch project and the Open V Switch, you know, don't go building products that look just like ours and expecting to take away our revenue because it runs just like us, or we're going to go after you.
Right.
And the threat is there. Whether they would or not, we don't know. But it also looks bad for Cisco. So keep in mind that running these types of lawsuits has a negative PR effect that, you know, customers are smart. And they can look at this and go, make their own decisions about whether Cisco's doing this because they actually have something to defend, or whether it's because they're losing market share and they don't know how to win on their own merits.
You never look good when you look like you're being a bully. You can compete on product, you can compete on price, you can compete on having a better sales team, but when you start to go the legal route, then yeah, in this case, I feel like Cisco looks a little bit bullyish.
Well, especially when you read Cisco's blog post about it, which if you, you know, take a look at the blog, that there'll be a link in the show notes on this, but the blog post sort of goes, and it's pretty, you know, very childish, I sort of, or, you know, lacks a certain sensitivity to customers. It just sort of goes, yeah, we got you sort of thing. It doesn't actually, it claims that it's protecting innovation, but it doesn't read like that. Mm-hmm. It reads as if, you know, we got you.
Nasty cheater.
Yeah, something like that. It doesn't necessarily read like a grown-up behavior. They need to do a better job around that, I think.
So we're speculating that one of the reasons Cisco is doing this is to create a little FUD among the customer base. We don't know how customers are necessarily reacting. We do know how the financial markets are reacting. And after the initial ruling coming out of the ITC, it turns out that Arista stock was up almost 6% the morning after the ruling, while Cisco stock dropped. And of course, stocks fluctuate all day, every day, up and down. So I don't know, want to read too much into it. But we found a story with a few financial analysts saying, Arista will get through this. It's not going to be a big deal. It's not going to hurt them. And we're still bullish on Arista.
And that seems to be a pervasive attitude. The things that I've read sort of suggest that the ITC ruling wasn't exactly the, you know, the strike to the knees that Cisco was hoping for. Only 3 of the 5 patents got up, and they weren't an instant banning of import. Like, it wasn't a clear violation. It's an initial determination that there might be a violation and there'll be a fuller ruling. The thing's still on track. But Arista keeps pointing out that there are many things going the other way. You know, I would generally agree that at the moment, Arista looks like it's all right. Now, having said that, keep in mind that a year ago when this lawsuit was launched, Arista's share price fell 25%.
Right.
6% up isn't exactly great news, but it's
not a full recovery.
It's not a full recovery. So yes, this is weighing on Arista's share price, and one wonders how much revenue Arista is losing to Cisco on the basis of fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
Yeah, it could be significant because that is a potent tool.
And, so and there is still a bunch of internal lawsuits going on as well. One of the founders of the company who claims he invented the database engine that's used.
This is Arista.
This is going back 2 or 3 years now. There are a bunch of lawsuits going on between the founders of the company about who owns some of the technology that's inside it. Mm-hmm. And that founder now works for Cisco, so a guy by the name of David Cheriton, who was part of the founding of Arista, as I understand it, now back at Cisco, and then launched a lawsuit on the basis of patents that he owned personally. It does seem like there's, you know, there's a whole lot of argy-bargy going on which hasn't made it out into the public light yet.
Right, and not to mention that Arista has launched its own antitrust suit against Cisco regarding the CLI, so we still have to work through all of that. I wonder if there's like a, you know, infrastructure as a service for the legal profession. Are they able to scale up to meet this legal demand all of a sudden?
The thing is about Arista, perhaps, is, of course, is that, you know, Andy Bechtolsheim is the majority shareholder in the company still. Mm-hmm. And he has as much – he's got plenty of cash. And as long as Arista's looking good, I'm sure he'll continue to support it financially. There's no reason for Arista to not keep fighting this lawsuit indefinitely. They can do that.
Sure.
One other thing, too, just to make which will weigh on the courts, I suspect, is that Arista is so confident of getting away with this is that they continue to put out – marketing data around SysDB. Now, SysDB is a fairly common concept in software design. It's not unique to networking. And Cisco keeps claiming that they own a patent on it, but I kind of find that rings hollow. I've seen SysDB referred to in many other software products around the world. It's just not called that. So Arista has SysDB, and last week it doubled down on SysDB with NetDB, which is fundamentally a distributed version. They had a bunch of announcements out about it. They don't seem to have any problems around keeping on saying, nope, SysDB is ours, and we're going to continue to innovate and produce more products, and we're going to talk about it. We're not removing the words from our marketing. We're not changing anything about the way we're going to market. They're keeping on going the way they are.
Yeah, they're going forward. Mm. And we will continue to go forward with our coverage as this story develops. Mm. And we're going to stick with Cisco for a minute because this week Cisco spent $1.4 billion on an IoT service provider called Jasper Technologies.
Fantastic move. Very excited about Cisco doing this. This makes perfect sense. Instead of focusing on the negative, Cisco's focusing on the positive. You may remember last week we were talking to Stacey Higginbotham about IoT technologies for a while, and I intimated that what companies need to build is platforms on which people who make IoT nodes can come and join into. And Jasper is exactly that. I got that one right. Have you got that spreadsheet handy?
Ding,
ding. It's a platform. Jasper is a billion-dollar company that has been building an IoT platform since the early 2000s. Apparently, it has a real go-getter of a CEO, which means he'll fit right into Cisco. That is, he's a deal killer and really goes out there. They've got relationships with all sorts of really, really big companies, GE, Johnson Controls, and those types of companies. And they have a massive cloud platform. So this is a place where they can, Cisco can go out and use its financial size and capacity to do partnerships with General Electric and Philips Lighting and Tyco and Johnson Controls and those types of companies and say, well, we've got this networking technology and we've got this cloud platform. All you've got to do is bring your sensors and then write some apps on top of our platform and money.
I looked over Jasper. It sounds like they do a SaaS-based monitoring and management system for connected mm-hmm. devices, so like onboarding mobile devices in an enterprise and monitoring industrial controls in a factory. And it seems to me like it's an opportunity for Cisco. Clearly, they want to have a stake in IoT, and this lets them, go sort of a level up. Instead of just being in the plumbing for IoT, now they can also start – they have a services play as well.
Mm. This is more like the Meraki model, and Meraki has really worked for Cisco. You know, they've managed to turn that into a – and not just a little bit of profit, but raining from the sky profits that are largely offsetting the losses in the enterprise.
And Meraki is a cloud-based WLAN, cloud monitor.
It's cloud more than cloud. WLAN. It's more than just WLAN. It's also switched and campus and increasingly stretching into new markets. Mm-hmm. So customers who do want to build cloud-based services in their data centers and for their IT, that's what Meraki is. So it's very much in that model, in the cloud. Last week I said, Cisco's been building things around Intercloud and Project Mantle and Project Contive to enable IoT, but steadily building it up from inside. And they've obviously decided that's not working fast enough. Let's just go and buy somebody. Mm-hmm. So it is quite – what makes this perhaps a little unique or notable to me is that they actually spent US dollars to buy this instead of buying something offshore, which means mm-hmm. they really, really wanted it. Like I said, money offshore means it's avoiding tax.
Yes.
And so that's why they've been buying up startups offshore like the UK or in Europe or, you know, so forth. This has actually been spent as US dollars, which means they actually really wanted it. It wasn't just sort of a buy to bolster up a weakness or extend an existing technology. This is a strategic move right the way mm-hmm. down.
All right, and moving on, Greg, you pulled this out. It's some market data from IDC around cloud. The headline is cloud environments will account for a third of worldwide spending on enterprise IT infrastructure in 2015, led by the growth of public cloud data centers.
Yeah, so IDC releases these headline articles to try and convince you to go and buy their reports. This one is saying that 30% of spending next year will be on cloud. When you dig into it, it's not just cloud, not public cloud, it's both private and public. And what they're trying to say is 40% of IT spending next year will be spent on private and public cloud. And something like, I think it's 15% will be private and 25% will be public cloud. That's not surprising. What is surprising is that people are recognizing that there's an increasing spending around private cloud and that it's, you know, on a par with, but lagging slightly behind spending in the public cloud.
Right. Although it also points out that non-cloud infrastructure spending is still the biggest segment of the market, $67 billion, in comparison to the spending on cloud IT infrastructure.
Enterprise IT doesn't change fast. No surprise there, right?
Right.
So when you're on decade-long ownership cycles because vendors have convinced you that you should be able to treat these assets like they're heirlooms, like a mainframe.
Precious.
Yeah, she should be able to pass your precious on to your successor instead of treating them like printer cartridges. You know, that's the two extremes. As you know, this is an heirloom. We buy an app and we commit millions and millions of dollars to this app. And
we lovingly monitor and maintain it.
Yes, for 20 years or 30 years. That's what we expect to get out of it. And, you know, ROI is calculated on over a decade. But really, we're moving to an era where assets should be regarded as consumable items and they should be bought and discarded on 1 to 3 year horizons. And software should be regarded as a disposable or a consumable. That is, you buy an app today and it just continually iterates. You develop, you iterate, you develop, you iterate. You don't buy an off-the-shelf product anymore. You build it and develop it or buy it as a cloud service, which iterates, 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 right?
Right.
So this is a massive change, and this is where I think this, you know, enterprise IT has these heirloom assets. They will continue to suck up vast amounts of funding for the foreseeable future, and that's why incumbents aren't displaced.
I should note that even though the non-cloud spending is still the largest segment, it is declining. They said 1.1% in 2015. So while it's still the biggest, it's on the downward slope, while the public and private cloud spending is on that upward slope.
Things like, you know, VMware, if you're looking at NSX or vRealize, if you're planning an OpenStack, that's private cloud. Maybe you're looking at containers and Kubernetes or one of the other container orchestration platforms. Those are all private cloud technologies. Moving away from the old days of Windows to Linux, virtualization, that's the future of a private cloud with automation and orchestration increasingly coming in.
This is another IDC report that you called out about how line of business leaders are going directly to IT suppliers, so a Cisco and HP and EMC, IBM, Dell, et cetera, rather than their own internal organization. And what jumped out at you about this?
You can say I'm having a good week because I've obviously caught up on my RSS feed. Obviously, I got down to the I's in the IDC.
I'm trying to think what's J. What can we find in J?
Yeah. There was just a couple of things that I think I read this and then put it aside to thinking whether it was interesting or not. But what IDC is trying to suggest here is that IT managers are no longer making the IT buying decisions. The executives are devolving the decisions on what they buy to the line of business. So the sales manager goes off and talks to the vendors directly about sales products, or the head of accounting goes off and talks to accounting providers, and the IT department is not actually involved in the purchasing process. And what's interesting is it says up to 40% of companies in Romania and Poland, that's a very obscure market to be surveying. It's the line of business who pays. So the funding for IT doesn't come from IT, it comes from the line of business. the sort of the summary, again, this is a report that you'd have to pay many tens of thousands of dollars to access it. The summary sort of suggests that if you are an IT person, you need to get good at getting between the vendor and the line of business if you want to survive.
This report focuses on Central and Eastern Europe, but you know, we've heard trends about how line of business is taking, especially with software as a service and structure as a service, when line of business can do that end run around IT. So this it's not just a Central and Eastern European issue.
It's interesting though, isn't it? Because the more you cut IT out of the loop, the less resources it's got to help you.
You may get some short-term benefit from being able to say, oh, we're just going to go to the cloud and do this with software as a service. But IT really plays a role in an organization, and you can't just be without it.
Yeah, it's often hidden. It's a bit like purchasing clerks. You know, you don't notice they're there until they're not there.
Right. You know, or, wait a minute.
Hang on. What is that? So it's going to be interesting to see how this pans out, because if a company runs out of expertise in a given area, the seller, you know, or the vendor becomes dominant in the relationship. And as I've often alluded to in this conversation, as the enterprise empties out of its expertise, customers become dumber and dumber during the purchase.
You become captive. Well, we've come to the time in our show when we want to thank our sponsor, Interop. Interop's the leading independent IT conference, and the Packet Pushers are putting together a two-day Future of Networking Summit for Interop Las Vegas 2016. And Greg, do you want to tell us a little bit about what's going to be on the show?
What we're trying to do here is what we try and do in much of the Packet Pushers podcast, which is look to the future. Don't stand there staring at your feet, looking at the and thinking, this is where I am. Put your eyes up, look forward to the future and think, where are we going to be in 5 years or 10 years? So that when people come down to you, you know, like I just in the previous article, and say, what does this look like over a 5 to 10 year? You've got something to add or something to contribute to the conversation. Mm-hmm. So we've put together a series of conversations. So it's not just about people presenting to you. We're also going to be doing adversarial presentations. That's where somebody's talking and then somebody else will be on the stage with them asking them questions podcast style during the presentation. So they have to justify themselves and extend themselves. We're also going to be doing some panels where Ethan and I will moderate podcast style again, conversations on topics that are actually interesting. And then we're also going to be having a meetup while we're there. If you come along and attend the conference, then join us on the Tuesday night. We're going to be having drinks in the Rera. Monday night.
Yep.
All right. Close.
Monday night in the Rera.
Monday night.
Well, you might be there Tuesday too, but Monday is when everybody will be there.
I probably will. I actually quite like the Rera if I'm ever there. But yeah, so chance to come along, join us, listen to us, and a bunch of really like hand-selected speakers talk about the future of networking. We've also got a meetup where you can come and meet us and other people like you. Often networking people work alone or without identification. There'll be a lot of very strange networking people who will be there you can actually chat to and tell your war stories too. It's going to be great. I'm actually super looking forward to it.
And besides the Future Networking Summit the Packet Pushers is putting on, Interop also has a full slate of independent content on security, virtualization, IT leadership, SDN, networking. So you can come and spend 2, 3, 4, 5 days and really immerse yourself in what's going on in the industry. So make your plans to join us at Interop Las Vegas. It's May 2nd through the 6th at the Mandalay Bay Hotel and Conference Center. And if you use the code PPushers when you register, that's PPushers, you can get 25% off conference passes. And thanks again, Interop, for being a sponsor. Okay, getting back to the news, we talk a lot about security, privacy, government surveillance, particularly with noises from various governments about wanting to install backdoors in crypto systems, which, for my opinion, is a terrible idea. But I came across this blog from Arata Security where the author essentially openly declares his willingness to take up arms against the government if they get some kind of crypto ban or a weakening of encryption systems. And he writes, "This is an issue we are willing to take up arms over. If Congress were to pass a law outlawing strong crypto, I'd move to a non-extradition country, declare the revolution, and start working to bring down the government." Wow. That seems – I mean, you know, on one sense, hats off for being so passionate about it. On the other hand, I feel like this seems a little extreme. It's a little bit extreme. And I'm curious, is this just sort of blog posturing or is this a deeply held belief? And if so, how widely is it shared?
As somebody who lives outside of America, doesn't everybody talk that way? I don't know.
It's election season, so the rhetoric has been ratcheted up several notches. It's not always like this.
But I just sort of hear this sort of I'm straight out of the movies posturing type thing. You see a lot of people do this sort of thing on Facebook. Oh, people do this, I'm dumb, gonna. And then next week you see them No, they aren't. They didn't do anything. They were just making noises, mm-hmm. if you know what I mean.
Sure.
If you're one of these people in America who's very concerned about the government getting inside your head, a backdoor security like this would get you upset. But equally, what we know in America is that the right-wing people who follow the right-wing politics, which is the gun nuts and the libertarians and all that sort of stuff, they also get really upset if the NSA can't track down the bad guys and prevent the terrorists. So I'm not 100% sure how the government wins.
This is what I actually find really frustrating about our current political environment, that from the Republican, from the right-wing side of the House, there hasn't been more outrage about NSA surveillance, about weakening our own privacy and security, our ability to manage our own privacy. I'm really surprised that I haven't heard more about that from side of the political party.
I mean, if people were really getting upset about things, then fine, then that would be reflected in government policy. But the Tea Party is the company, is the part, you know, the extreme right wing is the organization that wants to see the back doors put in place. So when a libertarian stands up and says, I'm going to start an armed insurrection and commence a terrorist campaign against the US government, it just sort of like, dude, whatever. Just
well, I think the issue, it's so frustrating. I feel like the folks who aren't necessarily screaming about their own privacy are thinking they'll only use it against the terrorists. They'll only, you know, spy against the terrorists, and therefore I'm okay with it. But history shows that once you give over a power to the government, they use it for whatever they want.
Yeah, and, you know, I must admit, the more you get this surveillance state, you're much closer to a right-wing fascist state than you think.
Right.
But, you know, I don't want to wax on about politics. And the same thing's happening here in the UK, right?
And, it is happening, yes.
Right? So it's not like it's unique to America. It's happening right the way across society. Mm-hmm. My advice, start paying more taxes. You need a lot of money to run a human intelligence operation. If you pay more taxes, then you'll have more ability to run intelligent ops that don't require low-cost technology intervention.
My advice is write your Congress folks, tell them that you don't want to see encryption systems weakened and that you value privacy, and down with government surveillance.
Yeah, and the idea behind democracy is your opinion doesn't really matter. It's everybody's opinion that matters.
Right, if we shout loud enough, hopefully they will get the message.
Yeah, that's the point. Democracy isn't about you, it's about if that makes sense.
But it is about me. It's all about me.
It's about all of the peoples, not just you. That's the thing.
This is a story that popped up last week. We didn't have time to get to it, but I thought it was interesting. Uber apparently is scaling up its data center to support growth. It's buying or leasing wholesale data center space, and this sort of flies contrary to the narrative of everybody's moving to the cloud. Uber decided it needed its own data center space to do whatever it is it's doing.
Yeah, not surprising. In the same way that LinkedIn this week announced that it's building its own switches, there's a point at which I think I've maintained this pretty solidly for the last however long, quite honestly, is that cloud works for certain business models and not for others. In particular, once you get beyond a certain scale, paying the gross profit margins that Amazon or Azure wants, it's much cheaper to build a private cloud.
Yeah.
If you are fundamentally public cloud remains for poor people. If you're the sort of person who is leasing your office furniture or leasing cars instead of buying them outright, then cloud is attractive to you because your business model isn't generating enough profit for you to have a comfortable, you know, long-term view. If you have a short-term business that only is going to last 6 months or a year, or you don't have enough profit to be confident you're still in business in a year, then knock yourself out, right?
I think it's a little more subtle than that. You can be an enterprise and have some private cloud, some public cloud, some traditional infrastructure. It doesn't have to be an either-or kind of thing. You don't have to be all in or all out. It's a silly distinction. So I don't think cloud's just for poor people. For some folks, it makes economic sense. For other folks, it makes business sense, and that's what you do.
And I'm pretty sure that Uber's still got a lot of services in the cloud somewhere.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, when you're a big company like Uber, when data is essentially what you're competing on, then you want to be the master of your own destiny. You don't want to be locked into a provider. You don't want to play games with a provider about how I move my data around, how I want to get it in, get it out, pay these exorbitant fees for it. So it makes sense to me that they're doing this. But that doesn't mean cloud is bad or cloud is good. It is what it is, and you take what you can from it.
Yes, indeed.
And that brings us to the end of the show.
Yeah, short show this week. Not too much happened.
So thank you for listening. If you like the show, please leave a review on iTunes or Facebook or tell your friends about it. And Greg, where can folks find you if they want to hear more from you?
People can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and on the Twitter as at etherealmind. And also a range of other fine social media locations.
Do you want to do that again?
No. It's okay, fine. Everybody knows.
And you can find me on Twitter at Drew_CM, and you can find my blogs at packetpushers.net. And thanks again to our sponsor, Interop. Please come and see us at the Future of Networking Summit. Interop Las Vegas is May 2nd through the 6th. And if you want to sign up and get a 25% discount on your conference pass, please use the code PPushers when you register. Bye-bye.